Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A worsening crisis. India struggles to handle a massive surge in COVID cases and deaths as many question the prime minister's leadership during the pandemic. Then the immigration agenda. We discuss policy changes aimed at reuniting formerly separated families with Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. And the battle for Yemen. We report from the front lines as Houthi rebel forces converge on the government's last stronghold and the war for control of the country intensifies.
The Houthis are just beyond this berm and over through those trees. The soldiers are in the trees fighting back at them.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. There is fresh optimism tonight in the U.S. pandemic recovery. The daily average of new cases is below 50,000 for the first time since October. And airline traffic is the highest since the pandemic began. But in India, the human disaster only worsens. Makeshift medical camps have sprung up, and official numbers show new infections at or near 400,000 a day. We will focus on India after the news summary. People across Mississippi spent today cleaning up after multiple tornadoes struck on Sunday. Intense storms swept through communities in and around Tupelo, tearing up trees and destroying homes. Some were in disbelief today after seeing the damage.
I really don't know. I just had never seen nothing like this before. That happened to me, you know. It just hurt.
There were no reports of deaths or injuries in Mississippi, but as the storm front moved east, a tornado was blamed for one death in Atlanta. President Biden says the U.S. will admit up to 62,500 refugees through September, when the federal fiscal year ends. Today's announcement came after he was criticized for keeping the Trump administration cap of 15,000. Also today, the Biden administration says that it's begun reuniting families who were separated at the southern border during the Trump era. We will talk with the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, later in the program. Three people are dead off San Diego, California, in a suspected human smuggling operation. 29 others were injured, and one remained in critical condition today. The boat broke apart Sunday in strong surf along a rocky shoreline. There was no word on the nationalities of the victims and survivors. In Elizabeth City, North Carolina, today's funeral for Andrew Brown, Jr. led to fresh calls for police accountability. Brown was shot and killed by sheriff's deputies last month, but a judge has blocked release of the body camera footage for now. As mourners filled a local church today, speakers, including family attorney Bakari Sellers, demanded immediate release of the video.
We're going to stand up for what we believe to be right. We're going to stand up for justice. We're going to stand up for Andrew Brown. We're going to stand up for his memory. We're going to stand up because we want to be free.
Brown's killing triggered protests in Elizabeth City for several days. The nation's top general, Mark Milley, says that he would consider letting independent prosecutors decide about pursuing sexual assault cases in the military. A review panel has recommended taking the decisions away from commanders. Milley chairs the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A federal trial began today in California on whether Apple's App Store is an illegal monopoly. Epic Games, maker of the popular video game Fortnite, alleges that Apple charges excessive fees to force out smaller developers. Apple denies it. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 238 points to close at 34,113. The NASDAQ fell 67 points, and the S&P 500 added 11. Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and his wife Melinda announced today they are divorcing. They said they will still work at their charitable foundation, the world's largest, but can no longer grow as a couple. The Gates have been married for 27 years and have three children. And Bob Abernathy, a longtime member of the PBS family, has died. He was founder and host of Religion and Ethics News Weekly, and for more than 40 years, an NBC News correspondent. In that role, he covered the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Bob Abernathy was 93 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas discusses reuniting families who were separated at the border. We report from the front lines of the intensifying war for control of Yemen. The Biden administration announces new restrictions on climate pollutants and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The COVID crisis in India is relentless and appears to be only worsening. As death tolls and infections skyrocket, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is under increasing political pressure. William Brangham reports.
This horrible sight is repeated across New Delhi today. Crematoriums running out of space for the victims of this virus. Many grieving families are told to just wait in line.
People have to wait for at least 5 to 7 hours before getting a chance to cremate the bodies. Although, as you can see, the bodies are being cremated rapidly, there's still a long queue of ambulances carrying bodies of COVID-19 victims outside the crematorium.
India reported 3,400 official COVID deaths yesterday and nearly 370,000 infections. It was 400,000 last Friday. But experts believe all these numbers are likely a vast underestimate of the true severity of this crisis. Widespread shortages of COVID tests and the numbers of cremated bodies have added to the discrepancies. The impact the coronavirus is having has created a horrific reality for many in India. Several hospitals still lack enough oxygen to treat patients, leaving families to look after the sick on their own.
We came twice, but they said home isolation is enough and sent us back. He was fine, recovered 75%. If oxygen was available, he would have survived. But without oxygen last night, he died.
Now, makeshift solutions are required to treat the growing numbers of the suffering. Ambulances line up outside a hospital, waiting for precious beds to open. Old train cars are transformed into isolation rooms for the infected. Amid the crisis, though, there are glimmers of hope. Shipments of relief supplies, everything from oxygen to protective gear, arrived from Italy, the UK, and Germany today. And vaccination efforts are starting to ramp up. Schools are being turned into makeshift vaccination centers. But to date, just 2% of adults have been vaccinated in this country of 1.3 billion people.
Across Delhi, we have started a mass vaccination drive for those aged 18 to 44 years. It's the first day today. We will take it further. Our target is to have at least 10 such centers at every school, and slowly we will increase it to 300 schools.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his political party suffered a major blow yesterday after losing regional elections in West Bengal, a clear sign that Modi's political reputation is being tested. Over the years, Modi has deployed Hindu nationalist rhetoric and nationalist policies that have raised his popularity and transformed India's politics. But his version of nationalism has bitterly divided Hindus from other ethnic groups in India. His refusal to stop holding large campaign rallies and to allow a huge Hindu religious festival are believed to be major contributors to this spike. And now, as a new, highly contagious variant has emerged in the country, Modi has resisted calls for any further lockdowns. I am joined now by someone who has been covering India's pandemic from the very beginning. Barkha Dutt is a journalist based in New Delhi. Her work appears in many places, including The Washington Post. Barkha Dutt, thank you very much for talking with us on the NewsHour. First off, I should say, you lost your father last week to this coronavirus, and I'm terribly sorry about your loss and especially grateful for you taking the time to talk with us. Could you just give us a sense of the latest of what you've been seeing on the ground there?
In some ways, it's been a surreal week because 15 months of my journalistic life have been spent reporting this pandemic. And when the news came home, when I lost my dad, in some ways I became every desolate family that I have reported on outside of hospital doors that are too overrun to make space for patients or cremation grounds that have run out of spaces. That having been said, I do want to underline that even in this moment of deep personal loss, I am aware that I have been luckier than most of my countrymen and women. However, when I look at what's happening on the streets of my country in the major cities, most Indians are not able to get a bed. They're not able to get a doctor. And if they do get a hospital bed, they are dying in hospital because of a murderous disruption in oxygen supply to our health facilities. So what we're seeing is, in the words of one doctor, healthcare workers who've been sent in to fight a nuclear war with a stick. It has been a monumental betrayal. It has been a monumental failure of policy. It has been a monumental illustration of misjudgment. And it has been a monumental absence of preparing for the second wave.
We mentioned how Prime Minister Modi has certainly seen his reputation badly dented because of this. And as we reported, he took a pretty bad beating in the state elections in West Bengal. Is it your sense that election and people's discontent is a real reflection on him and his failures here?
You know, just because I'm a hardened journalist, I don't draw quick political conclusions. I know a lot of people have wanted to see in that result some sort of comeuppance for the policy failures that have brought our country to this pass. I don't know, because this was a state election. The national election, which will decide the fate of Prime Minister Modi, is still 3 years away. Public memory is short. But what I can confirm is that pain and helplessness among people is turning to rage. Any number of people on the streets that I meet and interview with say, "What did we vote for you for?" And I think a lot of people are asking the following questions. Why did India gift away or export vaccines before it had enough for its own people? Why did India not order more vaccines? Why did the government continue to hold, including by the Prime Minister and the Home Minister, mammoth political rallies through the past month that this carnage has been unleashed on our people? There has been a flip and a turnaround on almost all of these decisions, but it's too late. And experts are telling me that there are not enough vaccines to take India out of the second wave. It's almost as if we have no choice but to live through the carnage. So yes, I think people are angry.
I know the Indian Supreme Court ruled recently that the government ought to reimpose some strict lockdowns, which we know caused incredible economic pain in India the first time around at the beginning of the year. Do you think that that's likely? Do you think the government will take that step to try to put this fire out?
I think that although the government was against a national lockdown, and I can actually see the logic for that, because we are such a big, diverse country, that maybe a one-size-fits-all formula doesn't work. I think we're now at such a cataclysmic inflection point that even those of us who've been critical of lockdowns are probably going to say you have no option. But a lockdown, if it's not accompanied by vaccines, William, is meaningless. And no matter which city I travel to, sometimes the gap between what the official data is reporting that day and what I'm physically counting myself is four times.
If, as you say, the numbers are being seriously undercounted, is that an administrative failure, or do you think it's something more overt, that they're trying to keep the numbers low?
I think at every level there is some attempt, a clumsy attempt to contain panic by keeping numbers relatively down. For example, a major doctor who owns laboratories that does RT-PCR testing for COVID told me that the moment his laboratories start returning results, which are very high, which reflect a very high positivity rate, he actually gets calls, he didn't name from whom, but he said from powerful people asking him to slow it down. This is on record to me in an interview. When it comes to fatalities, one of the things that's happening is not everybody is going to get a death certificate. Not everybody is getting a COVID test run once somebody has died. And I've also met extremely poor people who can't even find an ambulance to ferry the dead to crematoriums. So I think it's fair to say that we're certainly not counting all of our dead. An undertaker at one crematorium in Delhi told me that at the peak of the first wave in 2020, he was cremating 30 bodies at at his site in Delhi, and now he's cremating over 100 every night through this past week, when Delhi's overall figures, for example, reflect an implausible 400 for the entire city. So those are the kind of gaps we are seeing. Some of it, I would say, deliberate, some of it clumsy, some of it incompetence, and some of it just slipping through the cracks.
Even if you had enough vaccine for everyone in the country, those take a good deal of time to both be distributed and to get into people, as well as take weeks to start taking effect. So, I mean, there's still, it sounds like, worse to come for you all.
Well, you know, William, even speaking about my father had one jab, and I keep thinking if the vaccine program had rolled out earlier, if he'd had vaccines earlier, maybe if he'd had a second jab, maybe, just maybe, something would have worked out differently. Our vaccination rates are among the lowest they've been this week at a point when we needed them to be the highest. So yes, I think there's no easy way to say this, that vaccines are over as a way out for us out of this pandemic. Vaccine manufacturers in India have told us that shortages will continue through July. The only thing that can save some lives is a steady supply of high flow oxygen. And for reasons that the government cannot explain to us, we are not receiving that at all of our hospitals. And so this is an unprecedented humanitarian crisis unfolding here in my country.
Barkha Dutt in New Delhi, thank you very much for being here. And again, I'm deeply sorry about the loss of your father. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for having me, William.
The Biden administration announced today that it would reunite four families that U.S. officials separated at the U.S.-Mexico border during President Trump's time in office. More than 5,500 children were taken from their parents to deter illegal immigration. Those separations started in July 2017, nearly a year before the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy became official. The policy was eventually ended. The Biden administration says 1,000 families still remain separated. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, called today's announcement just the beginning of an ongoing effort to reverse those separations. And he joins me now. Welcome, Mr. Secretary. We appreciate your joining us. Four families out of about 1,000. Every family matters, of course. But tell us how you decided on those four. How were they chosen? And what was the process like getting this done?
Judy, thank you very much for having me. And it is absolutely correct. This is just the beginning. President Biden directed us from the very first day, do everything you can to reunite these families, to bring stability and resources to them, to help them in their healing. We are privileged to be a part of the effort that President Biden has directed. These families were not chosen for any particular reason, other than the fact that these four families are the first to benefit from our acts of conscience to really bring back, to restore humanity in the wake and in the shadow of the cruelty of the prior administration. These are first of many. We will reunite all of the families.
As we said, every family, of course, it's important for every family. But if it's taking this long to do just four families, help us understand why it's so hard. What are the obstacles?
The obstacles are many. Unfortunately, we inherited records that were incomplete, inaccurate, and the like. But also, what we're doing is building a foundation for a program. The American public will see families reunited at a quicker pace now that we have overcome some of the obstacles. We have a tremendous workforce across the federal government working in partnership with community-based organizations to deliver unification to these families. These are sons, daughters, sisters, brothers, fathers, mothers. We are so privileged to be a part of this effort. I think the pace is going to increase as the obstacles have been overcome. More obstacles.
And excuse me, but I'd like to read you a comment from the attorney for the ACLU, which, as you know, is behind several lawsuits filed to locate deported parents and the children they were separated from. His name is Lee Gallant. And he said, quote, reunification is not enough. The families, especially the babies and toddlers who were deliberately abused by our government, also need permanent legal status in the United States, social services, and compensation for the harm they suffered. He went on, there are hundreds of families who have not been even been located. And as I said before, more than 1,000 still separated. How long is it going to take to get these 1,000 families reunited?
Let me first, Judy, say what a formidable advocate Lee is in terms of, and his ACLU team, in terms of vindicating the rights of these families and fighting for their reunification. We are actually proud to fight alongside Lee Gelernt and the ACLU team. However long it's going to take, we're going to achieve our mission of reuniting all of the families, and we're working day and night to do so as quickly as possible. That is our commitment, and quite frankly, our obligation.
I saw that President Biden said last week, and I'm quoting, we don't know yet where those kids are. We're trying like hell to figure out what happened. Is it the case that you don't know where most of these children are?
We know where some are, and we don't know where others are. Not only that, when we know where they are and when we know where the parents are, remember, we as a government, because of what we've inherited, because of the cruelty that precedes us, we have to convince those parents on some occasions to actually have the courage to come forward, given the mistrust that the prior administration has sown. We are bringing conscience back to the government. It will take time. We have wonderful partners to work alongside, and we are committed to the effort.
Will the parents, will these families be allowed to stay in the United States? I mean, going back to Mr. Gelernt's point, will they receive social services? Will they receive permanent legal status?
We are working towards that. Mr. Gelernt is correct that the families need stability. They need resources to really have the healing process work. This reunification that we are achieving tomorrow, these four families will be reunified. This is just the beginning of that healing process. We intend to do more, and we're looking very carefully at what we can do.
So can you say at this point whether they will be allowed to stay in the United States?
So that is a legal question. What we have done is we have brought them into the United States under a program called humanitarian parole to allow them to stay in the United States for a certain period of time. And we are exploring what other avenues we can utilize to have them stay here with the stability that they need. That is very much uppermost in our minds.
And as we've reported, Mr. Secretary, these are families who tried, who were trying to enter the United States during the Trump administration. What about the families who've tried to enter during this administration, the Biden administration? What percentage of them have been allowed to come into the country? What percentage have been turned away?
So those are two very, very different things, if I may say, Judy. One is the Trump administration's practice of intentionally separating children from their parents to deter migration. The other is what we are doing with respect to families who arrive at the border in between the ports of entry, who seek to enter unlawfully during a time of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we, because of the public health imperative under the authorities of the CDC to protect not only the American public, but also the migrants themselves, are exercising that CDC authority and not allowing the families to enter the United States.
And finally, Mr. Secretary, President Biden is announcing this afternoon that he is raising the cap on the number of refugees. This is a somewhat different issue, but on refugees who would enter the United States from other countries for reasons of safety, for persecution in other, wherever their home countries are. Can you help us understand why this number was arrived at?
So this number, Judy, this number of 62,500 is a number that represents the number of refugees that we as a nation will accept, that to which we will aspire in this calendar year. Or I should say in this fiscal year for the United States government. This reflects President Biden's unwavering commitment to our refugee program, to our proudest heritage of leading the world in refugee admissions. This number was a balance between our highest aspirations and the realities, the fact that we will also have to rebuild the refugee system because of its dismantlement by the prior administration. So we are balancing our hopes and aspirations for people around the world who seek a legal pathway to humanitarian relief, and the fact that we've inherited a system that was torn apart.
We will leave it there. Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas of the Department of Homeland Security, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Judy.
It has been 3 months since President Biden ended American military involvement in the war in Yemen. The U.S. was providing logistical support to a Saudi-led coalition fighting rebels in the country known as Houthis, who are allied with Saudi Arabia's regional enemy, Iran. Before leaving office, former President Trump designated the Houthis a terrorist organization. President Biden reversed that move when aid agencies warned that it would make getting food to civilians in rebel-held areas harder. But as special correspondent Jane Ferguson tells us from the front lines, shortly after Mr. Biden's move, the Houthis launched an offensive east from the capital Sana'a toward the city of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed Yemeni government forces.
This is what 6 years of war in Yemen has come to, an ultimate battle in the desert for the future of this country. A small trench manned by government fighters with little more than AK-47s, fighting Iran-allied rebels called Houthis. Brigadier Abdulrahman Radman led us to where his men are trying to hold the line. That line is a vague, dusty mark in the desert.
The Houthis are just beyond this berm and over through those trees. The Yemeni soldiers are in the trees fighting back at them.
A major new offensive by the rebels to take this area called Marib began just days after President Biden said he would cancel a last-minute Trump designation of the Houthis as a terrorist group. These men believe that emboldened their enemy.
When the Biden administration took the Houthis off the terrorism list, they became more aggressive. They took the Houthis from the list of terrorists because of the humanitarian situation. But if they want to save people, the best thing is to put them on the list of terrorists.
The terrorism designation, however, would also have made it harder to get commercially traded food to civilians in rebel-held areas, accelerating a looming famine. As the brigadier arrived in the only armored vehicle for miles, they make use of the top gun to take the pressure off. With quick return fire, the Houthi fighters remind us of their presence too. Even in this vast expanse, the fighting is so close, it occupies just a thin strip of this landscape.
The Houthis are right there behind us, just about 50 meters away, the soldiers tell us. They're exchanging fire with them. This front line moves all the time as the Houthis try to push towards Marib.
The rebels constantly test the government forces' defenses. The fighting here is crude, brutal, close combat. Despite being backed financially and logistically by a Saudi-led coalition of countries, conditions on the front are tough for the Yemeni government troops. We traveled across Yemen's northeast desert to where this war has reached a climax. We heard no Saudi warplanes providing air support, and the only heavy weaponry we saw was this multiple rocket launch system. The medevac station is a shack with a few boxes of medicine. The only way to a hospital is the same way we came, in the back of a truck.
It's 2 hours from here over the desert in trucks for injured soldiers coming from the front. There's not one helicopter in the entire front line.
After years, Yemen's war is reaching a defining point. The Iran-allied Houthi rebels seized control of the capital Sana'a in 2014 and have been battling the government of Yemen and its troops, supported by the Saudi-led coalition, ever since. Back in nearby Marib City, both those fighting this war and those fleeing from it share its streets. Once a small desert town, This is now the center of a final government stand against advancing Houthi rebels. Soldiers with the internationally recognized Yemeni government and allied armed tribesmen rest and catch up between spasms of fighting. Those wounded on the front, the ones that make it back here, continue to fight for their lives at the hospital. Marib owns the country's main oil and gas resources. If the rebels take the city, it would not only push the government from its last major stronghold, but it would provide a vital financial lifeline to the Houthis. The defense minister of Yemen knows this is a fight his men cannot afford to lose.
The battle for Marib is one of defending our people, our nation, and freedom. We are in a battle to save the future of the next generation, the future of Yemen.
Rebuilding the Yemeni army in Marib after revolution, mutiny, and war has focused on professionalizing tribal fighters, recruiting those pushed from their homes by the Houthis and men from this region desperate to defend the city from a rebel takeover.
In the beginning of the war, it was only the resistance fighters, and they fought the Houthis in all governorates. And tribesmen fought. They have good experience in fighting.
The Saudis' main partner on the ground in Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, pulled most of its forces out in 2019. And Riyadh is under increasing pressure to wind down this war.
What will happen to the Yemeni military if the Saudis leave this war?
We thank them for everything they gave us, both military and civilian support to the official government. But I believe the Houthis will never leave Saudi Arabia alone, or the Gulf countries. God forbid the Houthis ever control this area. Victory must be ours.
The Biden administration has ended military support for the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen and appointed a new U.S. envoy for peace. This disastrous war has become synonymous with human suffering, creating the worst humanitarian disaster in the world and pushing millions to the brink of starvation. Potential peace talks and a ceasefire seem a long way off. Persuading the Houthis to come to the table before any Marib takeover will be difficult. Getting the Saudis to make a realistic offer of a ceasefire equally so. We also traveled to Houthi-controlled areas to interview a senior leader of the group. It has been over 2 years since we last spoke with Muhammad Ali al-Houthi.
Is it the intention to take Marib, or would you ever stop for talks before taking the city?
Liberating all of Yemen from the mercenaries and invaders is a duty for all Yemeni people. Who leads the fighters in Marib? It's either American or Saudi or Emirati soldiers.
Will there be no peace until you take Marib?
When we receive a serious approach to peace from them and practical steps, we will talk. But until now, nothing. All that is going on is just talk. Whether or not we advance on Marib depends on their practical steps.
While arguments over war and peace roll on, families fleeing their homes are constantly on the move. Rockets inching closer every day. Gunfire and explosions often crashing into these makeshift camps just behind the front lines. Tens of thousands of men, women, and children wait here for the war to end. While just beyond the hills, it rages. Those who cannot afford to live in the city set up camp in the dusty, unrelenting heat of the desert.
She says just today, 1,000 families. They've just scattered. They've had to leave and just scatter out further, pushing back further from the front line.
This woman did not want to give her name, but said she is here with her 5 children. I asked her if she was afraid. We never sleep, she tells me. We are afraid for our safety. We are afraid for our children. We fled our villages. We left our houses and our land. We left everything behind. They are chasing our husbands. They throw our children in jail. We got frightened, so we came here and they followed us. Where should we go? We thought the only thing we have is God and Marib. And now they want to take Marib from us. Some of the other women gather around to tell us of the fighting that followed them here. They hand me bullets and shrapnel they have gathered from the dirt around their tents, landing just short of their children, sleeping under thin canvas. We met Mohsen Nasser in an abandoned camp nearby. It's dangerous, he admitted, but at least he can graze his goats.
I don't think the war with the Houthis will ever stop. The Houthis will never negotiate. They just want death, not life.
I asked him if he thinks the Houthis will continue to try to take the city.
I hope they do not enter Marib. I asked God, where would the refugees go? Should they go to the desert to die? I don't think God will let it happen. Every time the war reaches us, we flee.
And still they come. Still they move when they have to. Families packing and unpacking their belongings is a ritual of survival here. The exhausted, dreary transits from one dusty patch to another, in search of safety, in search of the promise of hope. Hope for an end to this war. If efforts for a ceasefire do not succeed, these families will flee again. They are running out of places to go. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jane Ferguson in Marib, Yemen.
President Biden's plan to combat the growth of greenhouse gases has many facets to it and would affect many segments of our lives, power, transportation, housing, and more. Today, the EPA announced a new rule that targets a greenhouse gas that is important but less familiar to many Americans, hydrofluorocarbons. John Yang has the details.
Judy, hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, are powerful greenhouse gases that are widely used in both residential and commercial refrigeration, air conditioning, and heat pumps. Today's EPA proposal would cut the U.S. production and import of HFCs by 85% over the next 15 years. The agency estimates that would prevent almost a full degree Fahrenheit of warming by the end of the century. Christian Tadonio is a senior climate and energy advisor at the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development, which works to strengthen environmental laws. She worked previously in both the EPA and the Energy Department in the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations. Christian, thanks so much for joining us. In layman's terms, can you help us understand why HFCs are so potent in climate change?
Certainly. So we've all heard about carbon dioxide, or CO2, and we know that it is responsible for much of the world's warming. However, there are these other classes of climate pollutants called short-lived climate pollutants, of which HFCs are one of the most potent. So if you go out today and emit a pound of CO2, that creates a certain amount of warming. If you go out and emit a pound of HFCs, it is thousands of times as potent as CO2 at warming the globe. So that's why it's so important to be phasing these chemicals down.
Oftentimes when we see the EPA or see the government move to limit the production or the output of greenhouse gases, we see environmentalists on one side and industry on the other. But that's not the case in this instance. Is that right?
That is correct. This has been a remarkably bipartisan, common sense climate action. The American Innovation and Manufacturing Act, which passed and was actually signed into law by Trump last year, continues a legacy of bipartisan support for HFC mitigation efforts. You know, HFC mitigation was initially proposed under the Bush administration, continued and strengthened under the Obama administration, signed into law by the Trump administration, and now the Biden team is taking it in for the win for the United States to actually establish the U.S. as a leader on this issue.
And this proposal, today's proposal from the EPA, does not eliminate HFCs. It just sort of phases them down, but not to zero. And also, it doesn't limit their use in products, in sort of end-use products. Why is that?
So that's right. We know that scientists have told us we have about 10 years to take fast action on climate change, and mitigation of HFCs is one of the most important initial actions that we can take. So what EPA is doing here is really starting strong out of the gate and allocating to different sectors of the economy an amount of HFCs based on the allocation schedule that Congress actually passed. So this is a first step. We may and we hope to see EPA continue by setting common sense requirements for certain end-use applications. But today, what EPA is doing is sending a strong signal that the U.S. is ready to start phasing HFCs down, not out, down.
And are there readily available or substitutes for HFCs in refrigerators and air conditioners and the like?
If you bought a refrigerator recently, you might actually already have a climate-friendly alternative in use. So manufacturers, both in the United States and internationally, have been transitioning to alternatives for many years at this point. If you go out and buy a new car today, chances are your car is using a refrigerant that is much better for the climate. And the rest of the U.S. manufacturing sector is soon to follow with climate-friendly alternatives as well.
And viewers may be wondering, are they going to have to, will they have to replace their refrigerators and air conditioners? And will this add to the cost of those products?
In a word, no. This will not add to the cost of your products. And we know this because of history. We've already been through a transition in refrigerants before. Refrigerators used to use CFCs, which were not only ozone-depleting substances, they were incredibly potent greenhouse gases as well. And when industry transitioned from CFCs to protect the ozone layer, it had a good climate benefit. But we also saw over that same time period, consumer prices for refrigerators and other products like air conditioners come down. And we have no reason to expect that that trend will change.
I know that researchers have found that a big source of HFCs, the release of HFCs, is from refrigeration systems in grocery stores, leaks in these systems. How will this address that?
This is very true. So unlike domestic refrigeration, which tends not to leak too much, grocery stores use very large systems. This is a very different technology. They have many pipes and fittings, and so that does create a larger opportunity for leaks. It has been found that in the grocery sector, it's not uncommon to see leakage rates exceeding 20% per year. So what this initial step will do is send a signal to the U.S. Grocery industry that it's time to start the transition if you haven't started it already, and hopefully encourage them to start accounting for and better managing those refrigerant leaks. And, you know, doing so is not only common sense for the environment, it can also be common sense for business. Leading organizations are already finding that by managing these grocery store refrigerant emissions, they have fewer instances where they're losing food, right? Because there's a lot of product loss associated with a refrigerant loss. So it's a win-win for the environment and for the bottom line.
Kristin Tadonio, the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now it's time for our regular Politics Monday duo. Lisa Desjardins is in charge.
Thanks, Judy. President Biden traveled to Virginia today to pitch his American Families Plan, all while negotiations around his other large plan on infrastructure and climate continue. For more, I'm joined by Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and Tamara Keith of NPR. It will be another great Politics Monday, ladies. And let's start with you, Tam. President Biden is pitching these large concepts like reworking childcare in America by raising taxes on the wealthy. What are the political risks and rewards here for him and for Democrats?
He is pitching not just big government, but a big idea. The idea that government can work for people, that in a democracy, that government should function and should work for the people. And he is putting out what are generally in isolation quite popular ideas. And the risk is, though, that there are disagreements about how big it should be, what it should be, how it should be paid for, whether it should be paid for at all. And the issue is that they probably, you know, there's talk about bipartisanship, but they're probably going to get to a point where at least part of this is going to have to be Democrats going it alone. And he's going to need to keep Democrats together. And the way to do that is. It's challenging, but he needs them, particularly because there are moderate Democrats who are going to face difficult re-elections in the not-so-distant future in 2022.
Let's talk about the other party. Let's talk about Republicans and the tensions within their own party. today, after former President Trump issued a statement again saying that the 2020 election was fraudulent, he offered no evidence of that, we saw fellow Republican House Congresswoman from Wyoming, Liz Cheney, issue her own statement on Twitter. Listen to these words. She wrote, the 2020 presidential election was not stolen. Anyone who claims it was is spreading the big lie. Now, there is talk of whether Cheney can again survive as the number three leader in the House Republican caucus. My Republican sources were even texting with me about this. And this is at the same time as we saw this similar kind of reaction in Utah at the Utah Republican State Convention when Senator and former Republican nominee for the presidency, Mitt Romney, took the stage. Here's what happened.
That I wasn't a fan of our last president's character issues.
Yeah, those are boos. Amy, where are we for the battle for the Republican Party?
Well, the battle's over, Lisa, and Donald Trump won. It is Donald Trump's party. There are some stragglers who have continued to speak out against the president, as you pointed to, Congresswoman Cheney. But they are a very rare commodity right now. Many of them are already facing primary challenges. Many of them are, there aren't that many, but the ones who are there are could lose their primaries or get redrawn out of their districts in redistricting. And we saw most recently there was a special election this weekend in Texas to fill a Republican seat, not an overwhelmingly Republican seat, but still a Republican-leaning district outside of Dallas. Donald Trump's endorsed candidate did take the most votes. The candidate who was campaigning as the never-Trumper, who had gotten support from Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who, as we know, also voted for impeachment, has been outspoken about the Republican Party moving beyond Donald Trump. That candidate got 3%. So I think it's pretty clear that this is a party now that has decided to line up behind President Trump. The only question is what happens in 2022, especially in these battleground districts where Trump may endorse a candidate, and you may see Democrats using that endorsement against them in a general election, right? It may work in a primary. It's good to have the endorsement of Donald Trump in a primary if you're a Republican, but it may not be a great badge to wear in a state that's leaning more blue.
Tam.
Yeah, the former president really thrives on these sorts of feuds, and you saw him put out multiple statements today going after all of the people who Amy just mentioned. And part of this is he's trying to maintain relevance. He's trying to maintain control over the party. You know, it's clear that the never-Trumpers don't control the party, but it's not clear that Trump will ultimately be the standard bearer or if they will find someone else to sort of lead the path forward. And today, he put out this statement where he said, the big lie shall now forever be known as the election fraud, you know, making a false accusation about the election being stolen from him. He's now trying to rebrand the concept of the big lie, just like he tried to rebrand and successfully rebranded fake news back in 2017.
Amy, on that battle for the House of Representatives, the census actually brought some good news for Republicans in general. They may pick up a few seats because of population changes. And also, Democrats, we saw a key Democrat, Sherry Bustos of Illinois, say she's not going to run again. She's a rural Democrat. That's who they need. What do you make of all that?
Well, you're right. She's one of the handful of Democrats who represent a district that Donald Trump carried. But I think what the bigger challenge for Democrats, as you pointed out, is the fact that when it comes to redrawing these lines, Republicans have more opportunities to draw themselves good lines or, on the flip side, to draw out Democrats. And so we're hearing a lot of names, Lisa, of members right now, especially in places like Florida, who they know if you're a Democrat that the line drawers are coming for you. And so we're likely to hear folks there announce their retirements, potentially running for governor, running for other statewide offices. And that's the real issue here for Democrats coming into 2022. They've got history working against them. Traditionally, it's almost impossible for the party in the majority to pick up seats. They only have a 5-seat margin as it is. They don't have as the control of redistricting in as many of these big states as Republicans do. So I think the retirements are really a reality check. Many of these Democrats know that their districts are probably going to be a lot unfriendlier in the next election.
Tam, finishing this up, I want to talk about the politics of vaccines and vaccinations. You've been reporting on a focus group held by Republican consultant Frank Luntz, who was talking to people who were vaccine hesitant, but then ended up deciding to get the vaccine. I want to play some of what those people said about why they changed their minds.
I shifted my focus from myself to other people, to herd immunity, to a bigger picture outside of just this bubble. And that was when I decided to get the vaccine.
I came around because people are going to want to do things that they're not going to be able to do without the vaccine.
Tam, briefly, as we wrap up Politics Monday today, what's the message that politicians like President Biden should get about how they encourage people to vaccinate?
These are really, truly personal decisions. And for Lauren there, and I watched a previous focus group where she was a part of, where she was very hesitant. For her, it came down to things that she wanted to do in her life, including going to Yankee games. So for some people, it's about what opportunities vaccination opens up. For other people, it's about overcoming fear. And what I heard again and again is that doctors, your personal doctor was important for many of these hesitant folks to come over and get vaccinated. And the Biden administration is well aware of this. And I talked to a top official who says that they are working hard to get vaccines into doctors' offices, though that continues to be a bit of a logistical challenge.
All of this, such so many important topics. Thanks to both of you, Amy Walter, Tamara Keith.
You're welcome.
Interesting about getting vaccines into doctors' offices. And tonight on the PBS NewsHour online, 16 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized recreational marijuana over the past several years. But what happens to people with lingering drug convictions? We talk with experts and people with criminal records about the barriers these convictions create and some of the new proposals on the table to help them expunge their records. You can read more right now at pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.